Hey everyone, this is George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School for the No Film School podcast. I have a couple of special guests today, one of whom is a screenwriter who has written a number of extremely successful popular films. You've certainly seen them, as well as some extremely successful popular television shows that you've seen. We don't typically have a writer with this kind of resume or a filmmaker with this kind of resume on the podcast because we focus a lot on things like indie film, DIY, and it was kind of nice to get the perspective and the experience, especially now during quarantine and all the things that are happening in the world, to get the perspective from somebody who has this level of knowledge and experience working at the highest level in the industry. And the other guest is a filmmaker who has worked a lot with the writer, has done a lot more indie stuff, which is a little more close to what No Film School typically does. The guests are Chris McKenna and Bob Byington. And Chris and Bob go way back. They started out together, or their paths crossed early on, and we talk about that in the interview. But what I'm excited about in this, and what I'm excited for you to find, is sort of the variance of their experience, how they've stayed connected, and how they work with one another still. So yeah, it's always fun to bring in some new perspectives from different parts of the industry to the podcast. And, you know, Chris has executed successfully at a level with such a high degree of difficulty, and yet Bob is on the other end fighting for opportunities to execute something that's also extremely high degree of difficulty, but on the indie scale. And I just think the contrast is fascinating, and it's fun to combine it. So here we go. Thank you guys both for being here. We've been talking about doing this since, you know, what feels like 100 years ago, before there was a pandemic, before there was a insane amount of rioting and civil unrest and, you know, protests. And it was a different world not 3 months ago.
Yes.
But here we are. We made it happen. And I think, you know, what I wanted to start with was, I know that the project you guys were working on that we put up on No Film School not so long ago has shifted. Things have changed. You guys have rolled with the punches and there's new stuff going on. And I want to hear about, you know, what happened to the show, but, and the plans there, but also if you guys can tell me about the new project that you are working on together.
Well, I could quickly say that, you know, when the pandemic hit, the show seemed dumb to me, and I wrote a script that had kind of a tonal shift that was meant to account for the changes going on. And so we kind of got this other project up and running. Unfortunately, the world just changed again. So I guess I have to write another script. I don't think that's going to happen. But, and Chris has been helping out with that. But mostly Chris, you're, I think, also doing your day job into the pandemic.
Yeah. I am, I'm writing a movie right now for Sony and Marvel. It's the next live action Spider-Man movie. You have to be specific about which Spider-Man movie you're talking about.
You have to Google that to figure out who Spider-Man is. But there are a lot of Spider-Mans. There's a lot of Spider-Men.
There's also the Sony universe. You know, like the, you know, the Venom and of it all. And so yeah, keeping they're definitely wringing as much as they can out of this beloved character.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's part of the deal, though, right? There has to be a Spider-Man movie every 10 minutes to retain rights to Spider-Man.
Yeah, it's something like that, yeah.
But it makes sense why Spider-Man is beloved by all. And so what's the nature of your guys'? How did you guys first start working together?
God, we met such a long time ago through a mutual friend. I, at the time, was a copywriter. I think the first thing we actually collaborated on was a commercial for Guster. Is that right, Bob?
Yeah. And we did Triumph the Insult Comic Dog also.
Oh, right. Yeah. I was a copywriter.
Hey, great work on that, guys. That was great.
Thank you.
I didn't know you guys did that.
Just say I created Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, and
that's the only thing that you guys have done of note. I'm kidding.
Chris was at Warner Brothers Records. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. I was a freelance copywriter, and you just, you know, most of, you know, you would sit and you'd come up with a bunch of copy for stuff, and then it would always get boiled down to in stores now, or, you know, dropping Madonna, dropping November 11th or whatever. And
real Don Draper type stuff.
But the guy who took over, Jeff Aeroff, was liking some of the weirder stuff I would come up with. And he and Lori Burke, who was also running advertising there, like, they, you know, for Guster, they're wanting to do a spot. And they basically, like, they rarely did this kind of thing anymore. But they gave us a little bit of money, and I wrote a spot, and they liked, and then got Bob to, you know, direct it and produce it. And so it's this little thing you can see on YouTube. It's for Keep It Together, I think. And I thought Bob did a really great job. Has a unique look, and has funny performances from the child actors and the teacher. And it was just a really, like, oh, a 30-second spot that, God, when you still could get, I didn't even know you could at the time. This was probably back in what year, Bob?
Like 2003, I think.
Yeah, sounds right. And they ran it, like, I don't know. I don't know where they ran it. They ran it somewhere on TV.
MTV too. That was back, TV was completely different by then, back then, by the way, for the younger people listening.
Yeah.
There was only one channel. Just kidding. But it was, I mean, compared to now, it really was like when there was only one channel, you know, it was like just a whole different world.
And then Chris jumped to TV shortly thereafter. And Chris, I don't know where you went or what you did, but
I got hired. Well, I was a copywriter there. And after we made that commercial, I got hired with my baby brother, Matt, on our, basically our first TV gig. He was right out of college, a year or two out of college. And I was a decade older, and I finally got a TV job on Fox animated show called American Dad, Seth MacFarlane show, and that was the beginning of my TV career. So wrote on that for 5 seasons until the writer's strike.
2007.
I think that was 2007 or 2008. I can't remember.
And then Community.
Yeah.
For you, Chris. Yeah. And so and Bob, you and Chris, what I mean, and you guys have, so your guys' collaboration goes back to the beginning, really, for both of you.
Well, yeah. And then I made a fake doc in 2008 called Registered Sex Offender and asked Chris to help me with it. And so we did some test screenings out in LA that he kind of helped me with. And he had all these cool writer friends who helped, like, make the movie better. And then that movie premiered at South By in 2008 and still apparently has a nice cult following.
Nice.
Yeah.
South By is huge. I mean, that's a big, you know, and then so, and you've done a bunch of features since, and you guys have kind of woven, is that the way to, what I should say, back and forth into each other's careers a couple times. Can you tell me, like, how you guys are, you know, you're a writer, Bob, you're a writer and a director and a producer, Chris, you're a writer, you guys collaborate on the writing.
Well, I'm afraid it's directs,
a, or how it's do you a, guys work together?
It's kind of a one-way street. Chris has never asked me for any writing advice. And okay. I don't think he ever will. And whereas I kind of reach out to him when I need help. I trust his judgment. But it's a one-way street, unfortunately.
Well, to be fair, I worked in TV for a long time. You were working with a bunch of other writers, writers' rooms, creators, and, you know, from, I did American Dad, and then I went to Community, hopped over to the Mindy Project, and then back to Community to help Harmon run it for a couple seasons. And it's kind of hard at that point. Hey, Bob, can you read this draft that, like, that we're doing, about to do a punch up room on? I was just in a different situation where I wasn't really writing anything original at that point.
And of course the writing for it, and this is, you know, informative, look at no film school. If you guys aren't both familiar ish, you know, we're, it's educational for people at all levels, but people doing all things and curious about different aspects of the industry. And yeah, writing and show running in television is so completely different than like prepping a feature script or an original feature script.
I agree.
You can't say, you couldn't say to Bob, like you're saying, hey, we got episode, you know, 201-15. Like I need, like you got a whole staff, you got a whole schedule, you got a whole life of the world.
I know, but you could ask. I mean, you don't have to like, you don't have to do anything I'd say, but you could still just pretend.
Certain elements, you know, of your life, I'm sure probably made their way into a Chang storyline or a Dean Pelton storyline, I'm sure.
Thank you. And Kevin Corrigan, we shared, Kevin.
Yeah, that was great.
One of my favorite actors made his way into the community world in a kind of blending of worlds.
Yeah, he was in one of my favorite episodes that I got to write the draft of. It was called Conspiracy Theories and Interior Design, and it was this. It was all sort of a send up of conspiracy movies, and it was the introduction of Troy Nobbett's Blanket for It, that was really fun. And getting Corrigan, it was so great to have him. He was so perfect as Professor Professorson. this mysterious character who then he starred in a few more episodes of the show because he becomes the acting teacher of the school. He was a great actor to sort of become part of that community universe. And yeah, he was my connection to him was through Bob.
Dan Harmon is known for his names of characters, as I think you probably know, Chris. Dean Pelton is actually a pretty good friend of mine. I've known Dan for a long time, and Dean is a real guy, and he's out there.
Oh, that's right. That's
just
right.
Like a lot of the people. Yeah. Yep. A lot of the characters in the shows are just real people.
funny that he knows a friend named Dean Pelton, and he named the Dean, Dean Pelton. When I found that out, it was hilarious.
He's like, I need a Dean for this show. Dean. Oh, I know a guy named Dean Pelton.
Amazing.
But yes, I think that talking about the difference between what it is to write television and a movie kind of segues to how you had a show you guys were working on, like we talked about, and then you shifted gears into doing a feature, Bob. And Chris, are you serving as sort of like an advisor and an EP on that?
Well, I don't know what my official role is at this point, but I'm always there to help Bob when he asked for me to read something or, you know, see if I can get it to someone since I hobnob with all the stars.
Should we screen grab your text while you were reading this last script, the text you were sending me? This could be a companion piece to the,
I was in a cranky mood.
There's
a little
great,
cranky.
Well, now I gotta text. Know. Now I gotta know. I don't know what the script was. I gotta know where it came from. No, just kidding. You don't have to reveal all.
Really funny.
Well, then, yeah, say what it is, Bob, if you want. But I'll explain the context that it was the world was on fire and I hadn't slept in days. Anyway, that was the context for my cranky, because it was also like, I'm going to read all this way through, but you do these really annoying things on like the first three pages and it makes me want to throw the script across the room. Kind of.
Such as, let's hear.
I really love this and don't mean to be a dick, but there are a couple typos in the first few pages. Can we fix them quickly? That was the nice text. But the funniest one is definitely... No, he says, I'm honestly trying to plow through all the dippy typos, or maybe you think they're stylistic choices, but God damn it, aren't we professionals? It's taken me 15 minutes to get through the first three pages. Like it so far.
It was true. Yeah. I was cranky.
Typos, man. Like, I mean, I have a problem with typos. Let me tell
you. There aren't any typos in the script. It's like Chris goes ballistic if you don't put a period after EXT on page 7 and you've got to like hear about it. So
I think if you don't have consistent punctuation in your slug lines, that's considered a typo.
I don't think I could be accused of bad. Like I'm not that guy. I mean, I'm just not that guy.
You're not which guy?
I think that's a critical note.
I'm not the typos guy. I'm not the typos laden guy. I know.
But I'll tell you, we all hate reading people's scripts. I mean, let's be honest. Like, we all dread, like, oh, fuck.
Of course.
So anything that makes it feel like, oh, well, why am I seeing this and you're not seeing this thing? And because I know I'm going to have to read this and, like, give notes to you. Yeah, it comes from that sense that
it's a great note, actually, that people should be aware that anyone reading it wants the best possible looking version because it's hard to read scripts.
Thanks.
So I will say,
I'm not giving the note to you, Bob. I'm giving the note to the listeners.
It's an inversion of that. It's every person reading a script is looking for any reason not to finish the script. Yes. Like, and a typo can be enough for some people going, well, this is unprofessional. You don't even, you know, it's not like, you know, Bob put it in like, some crazy font or something, which is like an instant no. I don't need to read, you're going to be whimsical and put it in, I don't know, Helvetica or something.
Comic Sans.
Well, the happy ending is Chris liked it enough to get it to one of his hotshot movie star friends, and things are, you know, on track. So,
there we go. So typos be damned. It's in the hands of a hotshot movie star now.
And he did make it more readable by complaining about it. So,
yeah. Chris, does any of that come from television where you're getting scripts fast, or does that just come from, like you said, the reading a script is like already like you're subconsciously looking for reasons to stop?
Well, I mean, God knows. I mean, I cringe at, like, I didn't go to school for screenwriting, and I thought I was smart enough to just do it on my own, and I got a hold of a couple scripts, but I mean, I look at what the first screenplay I wrote, and it was like a novel. It was just like just so much description constantly. It's all those, you know, first screenplay mistakes just that you make. And then you then also learn you get a hold of scripts of movies that you like, and you see, like, sometimes there's a lot of description. You read like Lawrence Kasdan's, you know, like original drafts of Indiana Jones, and there's tons of description, but it's really compelling. But then you read other writers who just are able to be so much more efficient, because I think, like, because it's so hard, like, you don't want to read stuff, you want to turn a page and not have it just be giant blocks of text like you're reading a novel. And so you learn to be a little bit more efficient and make it like there's more white on the page than black, so that it seems, oh, I can get through this page and I can keep moving along. So, like, not you turn a page and go, oh man, like, thank you, Dostoevsky. Where's the dialogue? You just want to get to the dialogue.
I feel like I had been taught for a long time that you're not supposed to editorialize, so to speak, in your screenplay, like describe it, like just show us the action, et cetera, et cetera. And then I started reading the scripts by great screenwriters of like the movies I love. And I would see all of that and I would think, oh my God, they're doing it. You're not supposed to do it. And so I think it's kind of like there is no rule there, right? But it's like, would you say it's whatever makes it the best read possible?
Yes, I would say ultimately whatever makes it the best read possible. If tons of description, I mean, if you are an entertaining enough writer, like a William Goldman or Lawrence Kasdan, then I feel like, oh, then you're in, and you will read more description. But I feel like, you know, for me, I just don't want to overwhelm the reader. You want it to make a joyful read. And sometimes you don't want to skip over key description. But when you start turning it too novelistic, I feel like it could be easy just to lose your reader. And that's always my fear, is like, oh, man. And it's always then, you know, you're reading just for like pace, or like, oh, and then and I think just now working on so many TV shows and features and stuff, and seeing how stuff plays at table reads, and you just become less precious about stuff, and you don't become, you become, you know, you do kill your darlings at times because you're weighing pacing and you're weighing other things, and you're like, I got to get out of this scene. We've been in this scene forever.
I'm curious about this, and Bob, since you're on the indie filmmaking side a little bit, you can speak to it as well. Because you may have a different perspective. When you're writing, say, a sequel to a Spider-Man movie, are you still thinking about keeping people on the page and turning the pages in the same way you are when you're working on an indie that you're hoping to hand to a certain actor to get them. You know, these are obviously like you're dealing with studios, you're dealing with a massive, like one of the biggest brands in the world, like no pressure, right? But you're already in, so to speak.
Yeah.
Do the concerns still just boil down to, like, am I, yeah?
Some of the scripts we've sent out recently, I know I've imagined the actors reading them first and foremost, but I don't think Chris deals with that in the same way. Maybe he does.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm saying, Chris, is do you find that you're still looking at it in terms of, you know, what are the pressures of writing that versus are they the same? Are they the same as they were when you were just writing, you know, your script you're trying to get out the door, that you're just trying to get someone to read?
I mean, obviously the upside here is I'm hired, you know, to write something, and I'm you know, it's got a production date, and it's just now we gotta move the ball down the field, and everyone's gotta be on basically the same page. But you know, obviously though, then the other pressure is then you get fired if you don't deliver. And how do you deliver in a way that, you know, I'm working with Marvel, I'm working with Sony, I'm working with Amy Pascal, I'm working with the director, and various other executives. And so there is this, you know, and there's going to be stuff that some people love, that some people hate, and, you know, and sometimes I can tell who's going to hate what and who will love this. And then they clash, and it'll be like, because, you know, if this person really loves it, I bet this person's really going to hate it. And ultimately, though, you just have to write what you think is, oh, okay, well, I think this is entertaining, and my writing partner thinks this is entertaining, and we got to just now get it in and have them react. When you're making a big thing like this and you have a lot of people to please, yeah. It's funny because sometimes there can be a little bit of like, not inertia, but you're like, should we do it like this? Or what are you guys saying? Because you're saying that. And then you won't really get a straight answer because everyone's busy doing a bunch of other things. And then like our job, we started, you know, being called the reaction makers. Like we just need to take a stab at it and have people react to what this new idea is in the script. And then you give them the pages. And sometimes it's like, ah, oh, that's terrible. And but it's like, no, I hated that. Oh yeah, I hated that too. Great, thanks. We were just trying to get a reaction because we weren't getting a decision, but you guys just had to see it on the page and see whether it was something an idea you liked or you didn't like. So
wow,
that becomes part of it too. I mean, then there's a level of trust though, because this is my third Spider-Man movie, and then I worked with Marvel on Ant-Man and the Wasp, and I've helped out on, you know, other projects of theirs. And so, you know, but like this team right now, we've all worked together now for this is the third movie we worked on together. And
you've had enough
success. There's a lot of like shorthand.
Right. Yeah. You're not worried necessarily about, oh, if I turn in these pages and the reaction is bad, it's not the end times. It's just part of your guys' working process that has led to success. So yeah,
you hope. Thing. I mean, I went from being a producer in television where you get to go down and go to the director. No, it's not supposed to be blocked like this. And no, that we got to get this joke this way before he's got. Yeah, that's just a different. I mean, that's not how features work. So you know, I'm not a producer on these. I'm a writer. I'm a hired gun, and I think we have a lot of, you know, mutual respect and trust at this point. But it's just a different thing. You just. Sometimes though, like you hope, like, oh, that's not how, even in the last like pages I turned over, like for one of, you know, the current draft, I think some things weren't coming across, and like in a certain sequence, people were thinking that it was playing broad. And I'm like, no, I was actually going the exact opposite. I wanted this to be sort of like scary and intense, and it just wasn't coming across that way. And I think people just sort of misread it. So, and that's the tough thing about a screenplay is oftentimes tone just, you know, it's tricky to get tone across in any writing, but you know, with these sort of bare bones blueprints, sometimes it is. I mean, it does really come down to dialogue and how people hear things.
You know, I think people don't always understand that when you're writing something of this size for this size audience with this many factors, you end up making a lot of decisions based on the needs from these various sources, from a Marvel, a Sony, a director. They all have different, you know, you want to be on the same page, right? But you're getting stuff that from everybody that's different sometimes.
Yeah, but not only that, you'll like you find out like we've been in a hole, and they're like, oh, don't bother the guys, and then you know then we're not aware that there's like a oh, that giant sequence in 2B is totally changed now, and we're doing this thing with it, and we're like, oh, okay, you know, and you know, a lot of that is just because we're in writing mode right now, and oftentimes they just want to go, particularly with everything that's been going on, and you know, we've had to push, you know, production, and it's, you know, it's been difficult to get the ball all the way down the field, but we're getting there. And there's just sometimes, you know, in these monstrous things, there's just there's just information gaps.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. Bob, when you are writing, you're not dealing with that level of scrutiny and input, but in some ways, do you wish there, like, you know, you're sending it to Chris for notes, or you're sending it to some trusted eyes, or you're getting it to an actor, but so you get the freedom for your voice and direction to go wherever you kind of want. But does it almost like, it's just such an opposite side of the spectrum. It's kind of fascinating. You're like, it would be nice to get all this directive. Like, that's what I think when I hear it. Wow. You really get clear directive on like what works, what doesn't, instead of just trusting your own instinct, but you're relying so much on your own. Wow, this is, am I right about this? I'm the only one in the room, you know?
Well, yeah, like Chris said, you're trying to put a tone across. And for me, it was just kind of being, it was very solitary, this last script, and that's fine. I had worked with writers on the two movies previous, and I'm by nature looking for help when I'm writing, and I don't want to be alone. And this time I just sort of kind of said, okay, well, I'm just going to do this, and I'm not going to ask for help until I finish a draft. But I have great people who read stuff that I do. I've had, you know, the Sundance Lab assigned to me a mentor in 2007 who I still have, John Gaitans.
Awesome. We cover the labs a lot, and
yeah,
that's cool to hear that relationship endures.
Yeah, 13 years in, and it was the writer's strike that allowed him to kind of get into my life on a lab project in 2007, and he's helped me a ton, and I sent him the script, and he immediately had thoughts that were useful. And same with Chris. Chris is a tough customer, and if I'm going to send Chris a script, then I'm going to imagine him reading it, and that's going to help me, you know, get the typos fixed and get everything up and running before he gets eyes on it.
Chris, it seems like you're extremely busy, but are there projects you really want to do? You know, you're in a world where you're writing a lot of these, like, you know, extremely high level things that have like heavy demands. Are there projects you wish you were doing or that you want to do in the future? Less of the hired gun variety, the way you described it.
Yeah, my writing partner and I have a deal to write and direct something with a studio. And then we have some other things that we might be EPing, you know, supervising.
We want to do a Charles Portis movie, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're such huge Charles Portis fans. I don't know. I forget what the status of some of those rights are, but yeah, he definitely is one of my favorite writers of all time.
Yeah, meaning like an adaptation of another of his works. He's the True Grit writer, for those who aren't familiar.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
Norwood, that's the Dog of the South, Masters of Atlantis.
Do you find that that's a thing that I think about a lot with prolific screenwriters? There's sometimes a novelist, there's a voice sometimes. I always think about Quentin Tarantino, for example, having like such an Elmore Leonard voice. Mm-hmm. That if you read Elmore Leonard books, you suddenly think, oh, wow, that's where so much of that tone comes from, or that's where that world is. Mm. You know, Portis is an interesting one. Hearing from you, is that, you know, is that a heavy influence on your voice, or part of how you found it?
Well, I remember because I grew up becoming just being obsessed with TV and TV comedy, and a breakthrough in my life was like when I was probably 13, I stayed up late one night and I discovered this guy named David Letterman, and I just became obsessed to the point like it's just like I was like an idiot staying up till like 2 a.m. every night watching these and then having to be at school at 7. And so I had a comedic voice, and then my baby brother and I really hit it off over comedy and writing. And he was still like a teenager living at home, and he was reading a Rolling Stone article, I think with Conan O'Brien, or maybe it was David Cross, talking about how like their favorite author was Charles Portis. And a lot at that point, I think a lot of his books were like discontinued. So like my little brother, who probably didn't have a driver's license, would go down to the San Diego library and like find Charles Portis books. And that's how I got into him and started reading. And I just like, I devoured like all of his books in the span of a couple of weeks. Then they were re-released. I think it was a guy from Salon. I'm blanking on his name. Rosenblum or something, who sort of rediscovered Charles Portis for everyone. And then all the books came out in reprints. And I just devoured them. And he just spoke, because there's such humanity to him, but also such a dim view of humanity. Like, and the fact that you could write something like True Grit, which is just like Maddie, you know, I mean, she's just such a great character and has such a strong moral core. And then you can watch like Dog of the South, where it's just like these fools going all the way down to like Central America. It just really makes me laugh. I mean, and then Gringos is a great book, which in a lot of ways might be his most filmable one. I don't know if you guys have ever read Gringos, but there's just lines in it that just make me crack up. It's about a bunch of expat Americans living down in a small town in Mexico. And one of them's a bounty hunter, and it's just fantastic. And it all sort of centers around around 2000, 2K, Y2K. And it's just great. They're all just great.
You both have written comedy. Do you have comedy is, we don't get enough of it, in my opinion, and we're going to need a lot more, right? Probably need a lot more right now, but
it's all going to be musicals and guys and like supper clubs, people in tuxedos. It's going to be the Great Depression again, where people right, only I was gonna want say, escape.
Yes, when you look at the movies of the 1930s, you don't realize how different the actual 1930s were. Like, they were the exact opposite from the movies of the 1930s. Mm-hmm. What when you're writing comedy, though, it's really hard. I've done it with, you know, not nearly the success of the two of you. It's an extremely challenging thing. I sometimes think that people shy away because it's hard. What is your advice? Because I want more of, like, I want more people to try to do it, and I want more good comedy out there. But, you know, you've done it so effectively in places where it's so hard. I mean, how do you make Lego Batman funny, like, for kids and adults? You know, that's threading such a needle. I gotta like tip my hat. What's your advice from both of you, though? Because you're doing it in different ways.
Oh, well, my advice would be to, if you're a miserable person, then write comedy. I don't really know how else to say that. And I'm not really trying to be funny. I did have a call with a cinematographer yesterday, and he was talking about how miserable my main character was. And I was like, what the fuck? I mean, I just wrote the guy. I didn't write him as miserable. I just wrote him, you know, the way I saw the world, the way I saw him. And I think he comes off as pretty unhappy.
I'm sorry to hear that, but it sounds like that's helpful. I mean, we've heard that sort of overture before about comedy, is that there's so much pain in it, you know?
Yeah. Nor am I saying Chris is unhappy. You know, Chris is writing superhero movies, so I don't know if you need to be unhappy to do that.
Chris, how do you hang on to your misery to keep writing comedy?
Two small kids in a pandemic with writers and producer who calls me all the time, and I'm maybe don't drop this for a couple of weeks, because if she finds out I'm doing a podcast, I'm toast.
Okay. Yes.
But it, I will say it's been a really, really trying for everyone I know. And I can't even say I've gone through anything close to what so many people have gone through, but it's been obviously very hard for all of us. And so that's why actually getting on something like this and actually having a conversation with someone who's not a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old is a little kind of refreshing.
I agree.
Legos are. Are the Legos coming today? It's funny.
Sorry, I brought up Lego Batman.
No, I love that. I love that movie. And so much of that was the voice of Chris McKay, the director, who also wrote so much of that. But that was so much fun. And I think so much of that tone, he had worked with Phil Lord and Chris Miller on the Lego movie as sort of their on-site director, I think, like down in Australia. And anyway, his sensibility was so great. He's like, you know, he did some, I mean, that was a lot of fun to work on. And then, yeah. And then, you know, it's just the sensibility. Cause
you're a mensch for
kids movies. You can't be writing movies going, oh, well, I want to just entertain kids. You have to be writing to entertain yourself. And I think all the best comedy, even the, you know, in, you know, there's a, you know, maybe it's not all for a wide spectrum, but if you're going to do a movie like Lego Batman or a Pixar movie, you're swinging for a lot of people, and you can, and the kids, you don't have to dumb it down. You know, you don't have to be like, oh, well, this is just a kids movie. Cause like, who, I don't know. Then I don't like that.
You've swung for a lot of people and you've hit a bunch, and it's kind of amazing. So I think that like the advice coming from writing for yourself ultimately is valuable, but you know, very few people have that, can maintain the light touch across genre, across platform. So,
well, you look at, I mean, guys like the Coen brothers who obviously did a Charles Portis novel, but you watch even like, you know, what is it? Burn After Reading, which, you know, is probably a little broader and, but feels like in a way of like, oh, a bunch of dipshits, you know, that are, you know, like involved in, you know, like,
right. Yeah.
The government. And, you know, and so, but they obviously,
who knew it would come true, right?
Exactly. They are able to absolutely walk that line where they could do some really, you know, dark, closer to drama movies, but there's always a sort of like a comedic lightness, at least in parts of it, which I think then make it feel like it's, oh, this is a human comedy we're watching. I mean, Big Lebowski is just one, like, it's just the movie I've probably watched more than any other movie in my life. Yeah. And there's just such a joy in the characters, the dialogue, the production design, what they're going for. I mean, that to me is just the kind of movie I watch and go. So if I'm giving advice to anyone, I don't know how to give advice, except I guess watch the movies that you like, that you really enjoy, and don't try to maybe copy them, but find the things that you like about them. And I don't know. And then it helps you find your own voice. And then I guess ultimately you have to just be serving your own voice. I mean, look at Wes Anderson. I remember reading like a review of Bottle Rocket and taking my best friend going, this sounds interesting. Let's go check this out. And both of us walking out, and it was just like a total revelation. And it was kind of unlike anything I had quite seen before, but had such a gentle comedic touch to it. And obviously he had such love for those characters.
Yeah. I just thought Boogie Nights kind of fell into that too, same era, just like comedy and drama, somehow a human humorous element weaved in there that kept it going. But that's great advice. Guys, I want to thank you both for doing this.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you
for asking.
Thanks everyone for listening to this episode of the No Film School podcast. Please rate, like, subscribe, comment. Let us know what you liked. Let us know what you didn't like. Let us know what you'd like to hear in the future. Hope you enjoyed it. I really enjoyed speaking to both of these guys. I can't wait to see their projects coming out. And I would like to, as long as we're on the subject of screenwriting, remind everybody to take a look at our totally free, over 100-page screenwriting ebook, how to write a screenplay during quarantine. But even as quarantine may be coming to an end for many, this is still extremely helpful. You will finish writing a screenplay in 10 weeks if you follow this plan we've laid out. It's got tons of tools, steps, tricks, templates, forms, infographics, and examples. And it's from our very own Jason Hellerman. And we've talked about it on this podcast, but I'm really excited for people to take a look at it. Also, please check out the 5-day deal from the 5-day deal Foundation. We've partnered with them. This is a huge opportunity to get a ton of filmmaking assets, tools, educational resources for an extremely discounted price. And much of what you're giving in terms of payment goes to charity. So it's a complete win. Please definitely take a look at that and jump on that opportunity while it exists. I think there's only one day left, actually, when you're hearing this. So thanks, everybody. Hope you're good.